Hey guys, we just finished filming another episode of the Almost Made It podcast. This week we had on John Toscano.
He was the official F1 photographer for around 25 years. He ran Melrose Reception for 40 years, and then he also told us a story when he lent his cufflinks to Del Piero.
Let's jump straight in. Welcome back to another episode of the Almost Made It podcast, proudly brought to you by Cultural Club. Another big one this week. Special one for us because being huge F1 fans, we've got a legend of the sport, we'll say. And we don't really know which way to take it because I think he's met everyone on the planet. But ladies and gentlemen, please welcome photographer. We'll just say photographer for now, and then we'll get into the details after. John Toscano, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, guys. Thank you.
I think we'll just start from the beginning because I don't know where this is going to go.
Right.
But what was your childhood like? Where did you grow up? And then how did you get into photography?
Well, I was born in Maribyrnong. So my family on my mother's side has been here nearly 100 years. My grandfather, Bowler Spunnell, came out here in the mid-20s. My dad came out in the 50s. He had a fruit shop in Maribyrnong Road. He was a shoeman as well. He keeps reminding me he used to make shoes when he was 10, 12 years old. And we lived behind the fruit shop in Ascot Vale and then moved to Essendon, to Beaumaris, went to St. Bede's College, Mentone, and went to La Trobe University and discovered girls because St. Bede's was a... in Mentone, down near the Surfy Coast. So they didn't look too kindly on guys with black hair and one eyebrow. went to La Trobe and then we got into another family business, which we can talk about later. But my photography started when I was in my early teens. I just liked the camera. I share the same name as my grandfather, who was the town photographer in the little town in Calabria. And I'm told that he used to send away to Rome for the chemicals. He used to actually print his own photographs in the little stalla underneath where the chickens and the pecore were. So I've got Nonno Gianni's name. So I think that came from there.
That's nice. Yeah. Maybe we'll just touch on the family business real quick because if you're watching this and you're from Melbourne and you have an Italian background, 100% you know this place, absolute institution, Melrose Reception.
Yes, 40 years at Melrose up until last year. I went in as a 24-year-old and came out as a 63-year-old with no hair and the eyebrows went into two.
Can we mention your book real quick?
Yeah, well, look, so many things have happened and I remember a friend of mine years ago said, you should write down the things that happened. And I thought, well, I'll do that. And then in my not so much retirement but when I had spare time early last year after we got out, I started to pen down all those things that happened. And the working title is Chicken or Beef. That's what you usually hear in those environments. So, hopefully it'll make some good, funny reading.
Can you give us just maybe one story that sticks out?
Okay. Someone asked me this as well another time. You know, the bridal dance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you're getting ready for the bride and groom. And I think it was a Middle Eastern and Italian wedding, Southern Italian. So they're on the dance floor waiting and the DJ starts to play the song and I could hear, get up, get up, get up. And I looked, wake up, wake up, wake up. And it's sexual healing. As the bridal dance. So I raced over to the DJ. I said, what are you doing? It's the wrong song. It's got to be another song. He goes, no, that's what they want. So, and he surprised her with that song. So that poor girl's head was in his shoulder. She didn't even dare to look up.
Oh, God.
To play sexual healing for a bridal dance,
jeez,
a little bit, as they say, an embarrassment. You know?
What did the crowd think?
Just a dead kiss. We just said sensual. Yeah, it's like the quality. Nah, it's really, you know, sentimental, you know. So that was one of the things that stands out in my mind. And then you know, you've had the instance of a bride rolling up in a limo and suddenly storms out and she's heading towards the 7-Eleven and she didn't want to go through with the wedding. And bridesmaids are running off crying. The groomsmen are trying to calm the groom down. And I walked over to the limo and this poor limo driver is just shaking. And I said, "Hi, how are you, John?" He goes, "Oh, Alistair, you know, sir." I go, "What's up?" He goes, "It was terrible. They were screaming. There was threats to kill." And he goes, "I've never experienced that." I said, "That's okay. How many jobs have you done?" He goes, "This is my second job." I said, "Look, that's normal in European weddings. Yeah, they don't want to kill each other. And they're happy." So, look, there's a lot of stories I'll put them down on paper and hopefully one day I'll have it published and people can remember the times at Melrose.
Very much looking forward to it.
Yeah.
So what got you into the F1? How did that all come about?
That was back in 1983 and I was travelling to Europe and a friend of mine had a magazine here called Temple, Ettore Flacco, who I owe a debt of gratitude. And I used to follow Formula One on TV and watch it on Wild Water Sport on a Sunday night in the mid-70s in the days of Alan Jones, Andretti, Patrese, Ronnie Peterson, Niki Lauda. So I found out that there was a Grand Prix in Austria at the time when I was in Italy. So I asked him if he could do a letter of accreditation to the organisation, because in those days you submit an application. And to my surprise, they accepted. So I did my first Formula One Grand Prix in August of 1983. That was a really big thrill. It's not like now where you have to stand behind big barriers. In those days, you could stand up against the Armco and shoot it at thigh height, and even journalists were writing as cars were blaring past. So that was a big thrill. That was my first Grand Prix. Came back, a friend of mine, his family owned Il Globo, and they published a few photos. And from then on, when the Grand Prix came to Adelaide, I went to every Grand Prix in Adelaide and they published some works that led to the Grand Prix coming to Australia. And a friend of mine was there and showed him some work. And I asked him, "Look, I'd love to get a job, you know, once in a while working at the Grand Prix or something in the preliminary days, you know, the setup." And showed the photo manager my work and they offered me the job as the official photographer.
Wow.
So for the first 3 years, I was the official photographer of the Grand Prix here in Melbourne. And that was a great thrill. I mean, I'd never done a photography course and I'm also colorblind. And so that was a big thrill. And then years later, a few years ago, they had the 25th anniversary race. So they asked me to curate that for them and they used about 18 of the 25 photos were mine. So that was a big thrill. Yeah.
How, obviously, you would have been in the paddock. How close did you actually get to some of the drivers? Did you actually start relationships?
I knew a few of the drivers, And I knew, for example, Pedro Diniz very well. I knew Robbie Kubica very well. You would see other drivers and it was good because in those days you would see the new and up-and-coming drivers like Mika Häkkinen. Schumacher was in Adelaide and it was only his fifth race when I did the first photos of him. And you would get close to them. Some a little bit more amenable to others who you could talk to. It's not like now where you've got 10 PR people around them. You know, you would see, and I was younger then, you would see Gerhard Berger sitting on a Ferrari box, just leaning up against the wall there, and one of the guys from Gazzetta dello Sport would be talking to him. And that's how it was in those days. But now it's like, you know, I remember I had to ask Max Verstappen to do the 25 like that, just to hold it up for Melbourne's race. And I was in Abu Dhabi at the time. And to get him to do that, I had to do, I think, 3 letter requests and an email just for something that would take like 5 seconds.
Unreal.
Yeah. He did it for me.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, the rigmarole to go around, you know, because they're always busy, always flat out.
Yeah.
I've got a hanging question for you.
Sure.
Did you ever get to meet Senna?
Yes.
Wow.
What was that like? Because, like, he's a legend.
I met Senna and I've got some very, very nice autographs that he did for me the year before he passed away. And I've just completed a an exhibition of 40 years of work, and I sort of dedicated it to the 30 years since Ayrton lost his life 30 years ago this month, and also to Michael Schumacher's first world championship, which was in 1994 as well. So, yeah, I've got some really nice pictures of Ayrton, and I had some great access in those days. I was right in the pits with him in the garage, like watching him getting into his car, doing photographs of that. So that was a big thrill. When you look back at it now, you don't get that opportunity anymore.
What was he like? Because when we see photos and videos of him, you can almost see the presence. Yeah,
I didn't know him that well, and he would say hello or whatever, or you sometimes have a coffee with a mechanic and be walking past or something. But from what I was told, he was a very almost religious type of guy. He had an aura about him, and he was very spiritual.
Yeah.
And you know, whether that was something that enhanced his ability and driving to win three world championships. But he was very, very cluey, because on a Wednesday, the drivers walk around the track to familiarise themselves. He used to also walk onto the runoff area where the stones are, where if you come off, you're stuck.
Yeah.
But he would feel for the hardest consistency. And that's where he would take a chance and pass. Because even if he went off, he knew he could recover. And he used to look for those parts of the track. So he had that little knack of some extra kind of nous about him. And, you know, he won those three world championships, you know, within 7 years of being in Formula One.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
For us, he's a...
It's crazy because, like, we weren't around, obviously, we were born in 96, but still to this day, it's like... You know so much about it. It's like you feel like you were present in that time. Yeah. Like he's just something, there's something special about him, you know.
He's still very much revered. And if I post anything showing any of his photos, I get a lot of really nice comments. And I mean, he's bigger than the guy upstairs in Brazil.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Any interesting moments in the paddock? Surely there would have been some absolute.
Oh, well, I remember. Not so much in the paddock, but when Michael won his first world championship, they all went to celebrate at Ayr's house in the Hilton. And a lot of the drivers were there, and they tried to dack him in the middle of the dance floor, and there was no way he was letting. He looked like an octopus just going crazy. Legs are flying everywhere. They got his teammate, JJ Lethra or someone like that, and he was like... half out of it anyway, so he gladly pulled his pants off. So he was good. But look, you don't see many things that happen there. You know, might chase each other around, but Adelaide was good because the championship sometimes was down to the wire.
Yeah.
So you'd see complete jubilation, or you'd see, you know, so much sadness, especially in 86 when Mansell went off. And sometimes... I think there was that year three of them could have won the world championship on the last race. Wow. So it's a tense feeling. So sometimes they wouldn't be that kind of free. But at the end of the race, you'd always try and sneak into the parties where they were, and you know.
Were you there for the Adelaide race when I think Hill and Schumacher came to blows?
Yes.
Were you there, yeah?
Well, so much I was actually really lucky, because that's the year that Michael won his first world championship. And that was in 94, and they were both 1 point difference.
Yeah,
Michael was in front, and they smashed on lap 36.
Yeah.
Michael was heading back. Damon tried to keep going, and he obviously had to go into the pits to repair the suspension, and that wouldn't work. So he became world championship. I think to this day, Damon still, when he was in Adelaide last month for the for the festival in Adelaide, he was still sort of at the corner saying, this is where it happened.
Yeah.
Look, but he won the world championship
a
couple of years later. Look, I was very lucky, because Michael walked back into the pits, and there was about 100 photographers there, but I had stayed near the door. So I followed him in, and I got some very blurry photos, because everyone was pushing and shoving, and picked the best out of the blurry ones. And because I wanted something signed, because he'd only been in Formula One like 3 years.
Mm.
So he signed one for me, and it was one of the most popular shots that I've ever done, albeit blurry, because I always thought that photos had to be in focus and sharp. But when he looked at it and said, "Wow, a lot of movement in this," and another mechanic came over and said, "Yeah, you've frozen the emotion." I didn't know what I was doing with the camera, and I was going to say, "Yeah, I did it on purpose." Yeah. You know, so that was one of my highlights. And I remember they walked past each other, and they really gave each other Damon really gave him the greasies, because Damon's very intense. He almost looked like that big brother sign with the eyes and the eyebrows. Yeah. Sometimes we've taken some photos of him with just his helmet, and you feel somewhat scared when you're focusing in on him.
Well, what do you what goes through your head when you're trying to get these shots? Do you get nervous?
You get nervous because you've got a whole lot of other photographers, and I used to feel a lot like this with the Australian Open, because I did the Australian Open for 30 years. And like Formula One, you're in a big track, so you're thinking, where can I get something where it may be different, that point of difference? I got something like that in 96, where I was testing out a new lens that Nikon had lent me, and I went, and this is a case of being in the wrong place at the right time. So I'm testing out this 200 zoom lens in the top of the paddock as it's coming around the pin to go into the straight. And Michael Schumacher came around and never seen it. He hit the wall. His tie came off and he hit the wall like 6 or 7 times, and no one got that shot. I got it. So no one got it. So that was a double page spread overseas in Europe. And, you know, you try and look for something or a corner, especially everyone goes to the first corner.
Yeah, of course.
But you've got 100 photographers on the first corner, course, either 50 shooting down, 50 shooting high. So you've got to try and get somewhere else where, and obviously this time I was down turn 6 a lot, and, you know, you do your first half an hour and you think nothing's going to happen here. And as soon as you walk back, of course, George Russell tips over and people go, Did you get it? And I go, "No, I was walking back," because you're not going to think that anything's going to happen. So you either got to stay there. And I'm lucky enough that I get up to the podium, and my shot is for them when they look up at me with the trophy.
Wow.
So you yell out to them. Most of the time they look. This time I yelled out in Italian to Carlos, and I used an Italian swear word.
Mm.
And he did look up for like half a second, and I managed to get three frames.
Yeah.
And he's looking straight at me down the barrel, and that went all around the world and on the front cover of Autosport. So I was lucky. You never know when you're going to get that shot.
Yeah.
You just got to hope that when you're there that something different may happen.
Has there been a time where you've missed it?
Oh, yeah.
And you, like, regret it?
Yeah, because on that podium I used to hold my camera, yell, and they'd look. So by the time they look and you try and focus, they've gone. So this time I've learned yell while you've got it focused, and you just keep your finger on that shutter, because, you know, with digital cameras now you can take 50 shots in 2 seconds. So you just hope that you've got somebody where he's looking at you.
What about something else? Was there another incident, not even in F1, where you think to yourself, "Shit, I wish I could have got that shot," and you didn't?
Yeah, in tennis, I remember at one of the finals, Tsonga was reaching out, and he was right in front of me, and he was mid-air trying to hit the ball. And I had just zoomed in instead of staying wide, and you're supposed to get the ball in the shot, but there's no ball in the shot. There's just him holding the racket out. So it looks like he's just squatting a fly. And I thought, geez, if only I had gone wider.
Yeah.
And that happens quite a bit. If only I had a different lens, or if only I had zoomed out or what have you. But, you know, it's always good. You hope to learn that for next time, but the next time is a completely different set of circumstances.
Yeah. What was your favourite racetrack to shoot at? Did you have a particular corner, a particular spot around the world that you really loved?
Abu Dhabi, turn 12 is good because it comes underneath the hotel, the Yas Hotel. That's great because it's a real sharp left-hander. And Singapore on turn 3 is a very good one as well. you try and
your
get some
night shots.
The night shots are good because you can, if you're using a zoom, you get the lights that fade out, and you've just got these circles of faded lights, which make up a lot of the atmosphere. And they wear obviously the clear visor at night, so you can get the eyes.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's crazy. This might be a stupid question, but I don't really know, so I'm going to ask you: what's the when you're for like taking photos of an event, say a race? What's the goal? Like you take a great photo, then what? Are you selling that? Like, how's it?
Well, I work for an agency. I work for Sutton, and they're one of the biggest motorsport agencies in the world. So you would hope that if you have a great picture, you can sell it to someone or give it to someone. It depends where you are. If you're trying to start your career, you'd probably give it to them for, you know, for so they can publish it.
Yeah.
And I remember that a couple of times I did that with the Herald Sun. I got a couple of issues. That one of Schumacher when he went against the wall, I gave it to them. But if you've got an agency that you work with or a magazine, they'll take it. They might pay you for it. That's good. You build a relationship with those people. Even if you don't get paid the first time, you know, you supply them again and they might give you something. But it comes down to this. Do you want the money? What do you want the ability to keep shooting?
Right.
And sometimes you forego one for the bigger picture.
Yeah.
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 You want that name at the bottom of the photo, wherever it's published.
Yeah. Interesting. This is pretty cool. But how did you become friends with the Pope?
I wasn't becoming friends with the Pope.
Well,
I was going back to the tennis, the media manager at the tennis, a friend of mine, Michelle Bartlett, she left the Australian Open and went to work for herself in media management. So she was approached to be the media manager of the Papal Tour in 2008, World Youth Day. So they needed a photo manager. So not someone to take photos, but someone to control the photographers, allocate all the areas where the photographers would be in conjunction with the Vatican press boss. So she asked me. She knew I spoke Italian, or she didn't know I spoke more Calabrese than Italian. And I don't think there was going to be any Calabrese papal press secretaries there. So I took the job, and that was great. I was in Sydney. I was in Sydney a month, and it really turned me a little bit faith-wise to see devotion. When you go to Randwick Racecourse or Barangaroo and you see 250,000, 300,000 people that are there for one person and for their faith, of course, it's a real humbling experience. And I was very fortunate that I had sort of the closest access to the Pope, because I had to work out the positions for photographers and make sure they were all looked after, the security as well. And it was great. And even cardinals asked me if I could get them close to the Holy Father. You know, it was like they'd call me over and you see the sea of red and these mitre hats and, please, can you get me close to the Holy Father? I said, look, I can't, you know. I felt bad. I thought, you know, maybe you absolve me of all my sins or and something. But, it was a great experience. It was really good, and I was very happy to have that as part of my photographic management history.
Was this Pope John Paul?
No, it was Benedict.
Did you ever have any dialogue with him?
No. I mean, I was as close
really
as
close with him, but you never you got, said a word.
No,
yeah,
but
no,
you're not supposed to.
No, you can't.
Yeah, it's like when we were told not to look at Nicolas Cage in the eyes at the Grand Prix when we were photographing him. Yeah. Yeah, don't look at him in the eyes, guys.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
On the grid?
No, it's just wherever, in the paddock. Really? He was in the paddock, in the Ferrari paddock. Oh, really? We weren't allowed to look at him in the eyes, so it's sort of. I don't know how you were going to say, can you look this way, please?
I know.
Or something like that.
Nicolas Cage.
Well, they've all got these.
So, do you notice at Miami 2, Trump was in the paddock but no one took photos of him?
Yeah, yeah. And McLaren had to justify their invitation to the former
president.
Turns out everything
he touches, bud, turns to gold. They ended up winning the race.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe he was going to make McLaren great again, exactly. You know. And that was great because Lando won, of course, and that was a great effort for him after 100 Grand Prix that he finally got a win.
Crazy. Yeah. Before we get into a bit of football stories, I want to get your thoughts on Hamilton to Ferrari.
Well, I don't know what's happening there. And he I was like everybody else, like, yeah. What? How come? You know, because you're going to a place where Michael was so revered, who won two championships with Benetton, but five with Ferrari. And you would somehow like to think that Schumacher was that, that was it.
Yeah.
Now, Lewis going there, maybe to get an eighth world championship or to build up the team. I don't know why, because they've got two good drivers in Charles and Carlos. And Carlos has been going really well. And I'm somehow thinking maybe they've got something up their sleeve, Ferrari, engine-wise, with the new system, new regulations. And maybe they're going to do like Fernando went to Aston Martin.
Mm.
You know, or when Sebastian went to Aston Martin, you know, a team that's sort of almost there but probably needs the splinter of someone and maybe the motivation of someone who's won seven world championships to sit in that car and say, well, look, if he can't do it, no one can.
Yeah. So, I feel like too, like you're looking at Mercedes' form as well, and he's probably like seen a few things and been like, I'm not really getting anywhere here.
No,
but then he's got everything to gain at Ferrari.
Yeah.
And if he wins there.
And if you notice now on the broadcast, when they broadcast, he's sort of finding faults with the car and what have you. So, you know.
As much as I don't, like, I want him to win a title for us, like, Schumacher, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly. So we just have to.
It's a bit of a, Charles bring the title home.
Like we said, this one we keep in the pocket, Schumacher, and then we see what happens with Lewis. So I hope he does bring a bit popularity and a resurgence the prancing horse.
He'll fit in the mold, though.
I think so. I think look, they had Stefan Johansson in Ferrari. They had Nigel. They had Capelli, Prost. So, look, you know, they were all sort of former world champions or world champions when they went to Ferrari. So I think, look, they'll accept him.
Mm.
You know, he'll undertake his Italian. Lessons and
I think there's big possibilities also off track, you know, with the fashion side of things, you know, what he's and all this other stuff that he does.
He'll have to change from Tommy Hilfiger to Armani or something like that. You know?
But as long as he just keeps the racing and leaves the politics out of it, he'll do all right.
I think he can bring a whole package to the enthusiasts, to the young and up and coming fans, and to people who like to combine all those other things.
Yeah.
On the periphery of racing, but together with the actual racing and the brand.
Yeah, no, I think Ferrari's in the right direction, especially with Fred at the wheel.
He's
cooking up a nice buster.
He takes no crap. He says it how it is.
Exactly right. Yeah.
We'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
So you're a good friend of our new good friend, Santo Cilaro.
Yes.
You're telling us off air. And obviously, you know, we heard the Juve story from him.
Okay,
many Juve stories. So. Let's hear your Juve stories when they came down.
Well, I managed to befriend. It started, there was a guy who played for the Italian junior team in 1981, Giovanni Cotting, and he was signed to Juventus. So when they came out in 84, I got to meet him and he introduced me to the players and all that stuff. And he knew from a few years earlier that we'd sort of knew. I was working at a nightclub Inflation in those days as a part-time job, so we knew the places around town. So we got to meet the guys we needed. So I had a two-door Celica. So on most nights you would have five of them in my car. You'd have the late Shireya, Boniek, Gentile, sometimes Bonaparte's sons sitting on top of them, and Cabrini and Tardelli squeezing up in the front seat.
You know how ridiculous that sounds? I mean. That is just
legend over after
yeah,
legend.
Yeah, so we would go out and we would try and we'd get them into clubs. And they wanted to get out. They wanted to see Melbourne. Yeah, they just didn't want to train and go to the zoo. I remember one day they went to the zoo and they were looking at the kangaroo saying, Giovanni, che ora possiamo uscire stasera? So we'd pick them up 8, 9, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night and we'd go up. But that was a really great time. And I remember – I was with the boys, and they had to go to a special event at the St Kilda Town Hall. I think there was about 500 people. In those days, it was $100 a head in those days. And they wanted to go, but then they said, look, come and pick us up around 10 o'clock. We really want to go out and go to your Inflation or Underground or wherever it was. Or in those days, there was BB's, a club in Queen Street. So I rolled up there. I made sure I was dressed nicely, and they had a seat for me on the main table. So I was actually sitting in between Marco Tardelli and Antonio Cabrini and talking, and then people started coming to ask them for autographs, and it would go like Massimo Bonini, Gentile, Cabrini, and he'd pass it, and I'd go to pass it to Cabrini. He goes, no, 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 firma anche te, you sign. So I'd sign, so there's probably 50 menus from that night with a John Toscano, and they're probably going, che questo qua? Che ne anche un numero? No number underneath.
Youth talent.
So that was a fun night. And another night I was with Marco Tardelli, and we were driving up Punt Road looking for an address, and we couldn't find it. And there was no GPS, no mobile phones in those days, no Waves, nothing. It was just a Melways. And we pulled up to the petrol station just up the road here. And we went in, and I asked him for this address, and the guy was looking at me, and I noticed behind him on the counter he had the 1982 World Cup team poster, and he looked behind my shoulder where Tardelli was standing behind me, and then he looked, and then he looked at the poster, and then he looked at him, and it was like midnight, 11:30, something like that, and suddenly Marco Tardelli, one of his heroes, walks in, so... He was like, crowd. There was no selfies in those days. No. He gave him an autograph. And then luckily we got the address that we were looking for, you know. So, wow. Yeah, that was a great great weekend. And I was the custodian of Marco's watch. He had a beautiful Bulgari watch in those days. And I sat on the bench with them, and I think Santo was there as well, and watched them play. And he was asking for some translation because he was having a hard time with one of your former guests, Alan Davidson, on the pitch.
Davo, if you're watching.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
Nothing personal. So he said to me, he goes, how do I say this? Because I think there was a bit of rough play. And he wanted me to tell him how to say, I'll meet you in the change rooms after, you know. And I added the expletive, and it came out the wrong way because he tried to yell that, I cuff and wait for you after. You know? So lucky that didn't happen. Sportsmanship prevailed.
Yes, exactly. We showed us a snap before that you brought in of another Juve legend, Del Piero.
Yeah, yeah.
You had to give him your cufflinks? How did this come about?
I was asked by the people that brought him out if I wanted to be his photographer when he came to Sydney FC. But I was in Melbourne and... Well, trying to work out the details, how this was going to eventuate, who was going to pay me, who was going to this, what was I going to do. So I went up, I photographed his first training session. I think they published it over here in Gazzetta dello Sport as well. And they couldn't come to an agreement of who was going to pay me, you know, if it was them or us or what have you. So I came back to Melbourne and what have you. So he did a night here, and we were just there talking in his room, and he didn't have...
Was this at Crown? Yeah, I went to that.
Did you? Yeah. Well, he had no cufflinks. He forgot. He couldn't find them.
Yeah.
And he had a shirt that needed cufflinks. It was about 6 o'clock. Now, in my hospitality mentality of Melrose, I always had a pair of black shoes in the car and some black socks and a change of underwear and a tie and some cufflinks. So I had some cufflinks for him. So I saved the day for him that day, and I said, please, you've got to pose now. So he posed with his cuffs and saying whatever. And I think I put that on Instagram a few years ago. But that was my experience with Del Piero.
Is there anyone you haven't met?
No, I haven't.
This guy comes in photos of Sofia Loren, Del Piero, the Pope. Who else?
Well, you're lucky when you have photographic area that you can get close to some people, and sometimes it pays off that you actually get to meet them, or you try and get some great photos of them.
Incredible.
Are you a Juventino? Are you a Juventus fan?
Well, I'm a Bombers fan, so I was going for Milan, you know. Yeah, but I follow, it's like Formula One drivers when people say, who do you follow? Who's your favourite? But I follow a few of them because you follow sort of their history.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But it'd be different for you. You see them in a different light, you know what I mean? You get to know a couple, it's a little bit different. For us, we just watch them on TV, you know.
So, when they say, have you met Totti? And I said, yeah, I met Totti. I met him in a basketball match after the game. He was in Rome. Yeah, so I didn't meet him in the soccer environment, in the football environment. I met him in a completely different environment. And sometimes that's good because they're not overtaken by what's happening around them. You know, he was there as a guest watching us.
Did you meet him last weekend?
No, I didn't. No, because you know why? I'd like to stay with the memory that I had.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then the second time might be different, or the third time might be different. You know,
we went to the lunch. And
how was it?
He was so funny. Yeah. He was hilarious. We had a great time. Got to meet him. Got a photo. We posted it on our socials.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you could tell he was mezzo morto. He was dead, like jet lagged. Yeah. He's been dragged around everywhere.
Did he get the jokes at Vincennes?
Oh, that was bad. Yeah, I didn't go to that one.
I saw that video.
Yeah, he's probably like Woody Madonia after that. But nah, he was honestly, to be honest, what we noticed as well, obviously getting his balls busted a bit, but so down to earth, like just to have, like it was like talking at the bar with the boys, you know, just the way he'd like tell stories.
But like Senna, he had that
he had an aura about him.
Unbelievable. Yeah. It's like a lot of the drivers that they just like to take it easy, even in their retirement. When you see them afterwards, you know, if you get them in the right environment, they're quite open for a chat, you know, they can talk about a lot of things.
Do you still get nervous?
Yeah.
It's just, it means you care.
I do. I get nervous quite a bit, especially when I'm having to photograph something where I'm the only guy there. You know, and make sure we get this signage in, and we need three cars across and what have you. Thinking, oh my gosh, you know, you're going to get it, but it's the lead up to getting it, and you're waiting for the first corner to come round, and you have to make sure you've got the signage there, and then you're looking for the three cars, and which three cars is it that I want? Do I need to get Ferrari in it? Does the client want, you know, Verstappen or Lewis or Carlos? So you're nervous. Get a bit nervous, but then after the first lap, you're okay.
I feel like you just get thrust into these situations, and you just sort of got to float.
You do.
The photo of Sophia Loren.
That was like a Santos situation. I was there at Myers. She was working promoting her book. Right. It was in the early 80s, and I was standing there in front, and people were flying out. Questions to her and all that, and when you're in a crowd, there's hundreds of women screaming and yelling. She really couldn't understand, so I would just like sort of translate a couple of things to her. I thought she could speak English. Yeah. But I remember in the crowd when they took her away, I was standing next to her, and she goes, "Where are we going?" I said, "Here, grab my hand." So I actually walked down the back staircase of Myers into Little Bourke Street, and someone from the Herald Sun captured an image of me walking hand in hand, leading her through. Wow. So that was a great thrill. And then when Sophia Loren came out about 8-9 years ago, I showed her that photo, and she signed it for me.
Wow.
And I think it was newsworthy enough. Must have been a slow news day, because then I was on three of the network news stories that night.
Did she remember it?
I don't know if she remembered, but I certainly did. And then, you know, she was really good.
That's amazing. If you had to pick, I know this is a shocking question, but if you had to pick one photo of yours that you've taken that is your absolute favourite, what would it be?
Okay. It's a picture in 2005 of Giancarlo Fisichella when he won the Australian Grand Prix. He's standing out of his car with his fists in the air, one fist clenched, the other hand holding his steering wheel. On the side of that frame, there are two hands that are like that, stretched out. That for me is one of my favourites, because those two hands say more. They add to the environment of that picture. Sure, he won, but just two hands, and we're thinking, who was that guy?
Mm.
Who was it? And you can sort of tell, you know, if you do your neck like that, you're straining and you're thinking, what is he, tense or whatever.
Mm.
When you see the hands outstretched, like joy or exultation, that for me is one of my favourite pictures.
Yeah. Did you ever work out?
And the one of me and Cyndi Lauper.
Anyone else?
No.
Yeah, you're writing a book about Melrose. Write a book about your career.
Yeah, I might add a couple of chapters, actually. I might have to sit in with one of you guys and we can do a wider podcast one day.
I think so. We're going to have to get you on again. This is story after story. Unbelievable.
Well, there's a lot of years of opportunity and luck and people trusting me to do things for them. So I've been quite fortunate in that.
Going to any races this year? You got any plan that you're going to go to?
I'm just waiting now as we speak to see if I get the okay for Imola or Monte Carlo because they're a week apart.
Perfect.
There are a couple of races. I've got to go to Europe with my family later on in June, July. And I'm saying, well, you know, the British Grand Prix is on and the Belgian Grand Prix. Why don't you stay with your folks in Venice? And I might go away for the weekend. And so I've got those two on my agenda, Singapore, of course. Maybe Las Vegas and definitely Abu Dhabi. So I've probably got five.
In a couple of PAs.
Yeah.
Sure.
Was it all?
Please let us
know. Yeah, we need PAs instead of all the team, the drivers having six around
exactly.
them. Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Well, you got our number. You know where to find us.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I wanted to ask, if you could give, I guess, a piece of advice for maybe someone watching who's trying to get into photography, media, something like that, what would it be?
Well, it's fine that you say that because during my exhibition that I had in Chapel Street, I had a lot of people coming in and asking me that question. Mm. And the parents had the daughter or the son, they said, look, he wants to get into photography, but he's – I said, let him talk to me. So it's like everything else. If you really enjoy it, and it's a dream of yours, don't stop at the first wall. Do like I did. Find a way that you find a door that opens another door and you eventually get it. I mean, that's a cliched expression, but it does work. Now, one of those girls who you could tell in her conversation, she was a real fan, but she was a real photographic nut. Telling me about her cameras, what she uses and all that. So anyway, I took her into the pits. I had a spare pass for a couple of hours and I took her in. Now, she was shaking and she was shaking and crying. So much so that when she had a photo with Charles and she took some other photos of him, they actually told her to wait because they saw how emotional she was.
Really?
Now, that's great. So hopefully she might have a couple of those photos published in the local paper or online, and that's, you know, you don't give up. You don't get turned away because someone will eventually bend and allow you access or allow you to go that next step further. And I did it. You know, I didn't come up through a cadetship or with the Herald Sun or anything like that. I was just a kid from Essendon and just wanted to follow what I liked, you know, whether it was my grandfather's name that pushed me, you know, to do it. It's not impossible, you know. Yeah,
that's great advice. Yeah. I think you're spot on there because that's led to all your opportunities. You just kept going and these doors open, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether you know how it happens or not, it's going to happen, you know.
You be nice, you make your contacts along the way. You always, and that's what I've told our kids, always be nice, be humble. I've taken my son into the Grand Prix since he was about eight. He's 27 now and he was working at the Grand Prix with corporate people, but he knew how to handle those corporate people because he was given access of how and watching and observing how people, and if Robert Kubica's team said, John Luca can sit down and watch the race in the team garage, he knew how to behave.
Mm-hmm.
And now he behaves in a similar way when he's dealing with clients that he deals with now.
Amazing. Do you have any, before we finish up, do you have any exhibitions live at the moment? Or
no, I finished that one in at the end of last month in April. I'm looking at doing another one called Motor and Music. So it's a lot of the concerts that I've photographed while the Grand Prix are on. So, Abu Dhabi puts on some great concerts, so does Singapore. So Abu Dhabi, for example, has had Prince, Paul McCartney, Eminem, Linkin Park, Britney Spears, you know, Foo Fighters, Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
So I'd like to combine the music and the motor racing. Yeah. You know?
That'd be cool.
So we'll have that. Watch this space for that one.
For sure.
Compass.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, wrap it up. Thank you very, very much, John. That was unbelievable. We'll definitely have to get you on again.
Thanks very much.
We've just scratched the surface.
Yeah.
But if you haven't already, please make sure you follow John on Instagram.
Yep, John Toscano F1.
And make sure you go to all these upcoming exhibitions. We will, for sure. So thank you very much for
coming on. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. It's been a real treat and a real thrill. Thank you.
Thanks. If you haven't already, you guys know the drill. Follow us on Spotify, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook,
TikTok,
anything really. We're on everything. So drop us a like, follow. Thank you for listening to this episode, and can't wait to bring you another episode of the Almost Made It podcast. Thanks, guys.